Your sausage McMuffin with egg didn't change. Your receipt did. The sausage McMuffin with egg extra value meal includes a hash brown and a small coffee for just $5. Only at McDonald's for a limited time.
Price and participation may vary. Promotion pricing may be lower than meal pricing.
Hello friends and welcome to your Monday edition of the Kings of Anglia Ipswich Town podcast, proudly sponsored by Molecular UK. It's just a two-man show today, Stewie and Rossi both on days off to recover from having the weekend off, having covered Ipswich Town losing to Liverpool on Friday night. Didn't really go as we hoped or planned or in some ways expected, but I'm here to break it down now with my young friend Alex Jones. AJ, you had the weekend off. I was talking to you earlier. Obviously, with the spare weekend, you went to watch some football.
Yeah, damn right. What else do you do with your time off? I mean, when your whole life is built around the football, watching the football, covering the football, writing about the football, listening to things about the football, what else would you do in your spare time but take yourself to go and watch the league you've just been promoted out of? Having spent an entire season watching the Championship, I went back to the Championship to watch some West Ham v Derby County, your boys ? Derby County
boyhood side,
of course featuring Ipswich Town soon to not be player Sam Smoddocks in that team as well. I think he was the only ex-blue, so it wasn't much of an ex-blues watch. But yes, that was fun. Good to see some goals. Good way to spend the weekend in like the blazing sun still for some reason. And now back to reflect to the football that maybe wasn't as enjoyable for this one, unfortunately.
What was West Ham won that, didn't they? I can't remember.
Yes, they won 3-0, which was good. Having also spent most of the season trying just to be really bad. Like they lost at home to Charlton. And I said to Sophie, my wonderful girlfriend, don't worry, been there, seen this one before. Now this story goes. Draws against teams like Watford, sides like that. And of course, when we were first together, when we first went to go and watch West Ham, it was things like going to watch the European games. I remember saying to you, by the way, can I get that Thursday off? I'm going to go watch Bayer Leverkusen in the Europa League. And it's weird how quickly it can change. Where I was saying to her, oh yeah, after I've covered Ipswich playing Liverpool, we'll go and watch West Ham in the Championship against Derby. We've got a game against Bolton tomorrow night away from home. It's incredible how quickly things can change.
How did Smoddocks play? Was he any good?
Derby in general were pretty terrible. The game plan was go in there, defend and hang on for as long as possible. They hung on for about 9 minutes, I believe, until Joel Perreault scored. And at that point, Derby probably realised that their whole game plan had gone out the window. And as bad as West Ham actually were for large parts of that game, as bad as West Ham were, Derby were also really poor. Poor Sam Smoddocks just had to kind of buzz about chasing shadows. Of course, against the team he supports as well, the big West Ham fan from Essex. So I can't remember if he got to play in the Prem against West Ham at home. But either way, not the best of afternoons for him.
Right, that's the West Ham section of the pod ticked off. Shall we talk about Ipswich Town now, friends? Obviously, we're a few days removed from the game on Friday night, so we're not going to go into any great depth about the game itself. But I think what I'd like to call this pod today is thoughts, feelings and reflections. Reflections on the game and kind of themes around the game, and then kind of where we currently sit in terms of general feelings around the start to the season. So first of all, AJ, as I said at the start there, it wasn't the game that we hoped it would be. It was pretty much over as a game after 10 minutes, in fact. I think none of us actually predicted a defeat, did we? We all went for draws and Stu even went for a win. I genuinely felt strongly that Town were going to get something from this game or could get something from the game. And it's pretty deflating to see that they were essentially done after 10 minutes. I'm going to ask you just for your feeling on it, really, because I don't think mine has really changed. I felt very much that it was a step backwards Friday night. I know a lot of people are saying, well, we take the positives, it was Liverpool and they, you know, we didn't completely collapse at 2-0, but it felt to me like Liverpool were, if you'd allow me, indulge me a little fight analogy, friend, it felt to me like Liverpool were a boxer who knocked down the opponent twice in the first two rounds and then thought, I'll just have an easy night now, I'll just jab the head off for the rest of the fight, they can't do anything to me and I'll coast to a victory on points. It felt very much like Liverpool could go up through the gears whenever they wanted if they needed to, and Town didn't really lay a glove on them, which you know, for me, was a bit of a step backwards from the first two games, where Town, clearly they won the first game, and I thought they were good at Old Trafford until it all fell apart. And they looked threatening, which they didn't really look against Liverpool. 3 days since it happened, since you watched it, how are you feeling about it now?
Yeah, quite similar. I think that, to be honest, I sent this into our chat after the game, but the stats kind of painted almost the opposite picture, and you look at it and actually Ipswich won the XG, and you can look at that kind of in isolation and say, well, you can take that as a positive, but it's exactly as you say it. The reason Ipswich won the XG is because the game was over as a contest after 10 minutes, and that changed the game state, and that meant it was Ipswich chasing the game. And even then, they were only able to kind of edge it, and that kind of speaks to the chances, the ones that they conceded to, well, definitely one that was quite a low XG chance because it was from a tight angle. With that Isak first one that Sherpin should have done better with, and then the second one, which I'd imagine, I haven't actually looked at them, but I'd imagine is a much higher XG chance because Isak just rolls into the back of almost an empty net because of everything that goes on defensively there, which I'm sure we'll get into. And definitely a step back. I would agree with that, especially having gone to Old Trafford and then you're going away from home, and they put in a really good first half performance. And even up until the kind of, what was it, 12 minutes of madness, it all felt really positive and good. And even coming away from that 5-2, you say, oh, well, they were mugged off by VAR and things like the penalty and an unfortunate slip from Nunez. If that doesn't happen and Ipswich go into that game 1-0 up, who knows what that second half then goes and looks like. But ultimately, it's not to be. And then you have this one here where it's harder to take those positives, and it can feel a little bit like you're clutching at straws, doesn't it? Say, well, there's this and this and this was good. Ultimately, they did not really lay a glove on Liverpool at Portman Road. And there was just that feeling as well of kind of deja vu from the last Premier League season of how many times did we see Ipswich go a couple of goals behind early on, games over as a contest, and some of them they conceded 3, 4, 5, 6, and some of them the opposition just kind of didn't do that much and kind of toyed with them a little bit like Liverpool did, and ultimately was sat at the end of the game again, like that last Premier League season, saying we've been punished, of course, by a clinical team, but also from Ipswich's own mistakes, because both of those goals conceded were highly preventable.
Yeah, well, let's move on then to the next talking point I've got on my list, which is talking about defence, really, case of a defence or otherwise. I think I've been fairly consistent in saying that my main concern about this side is the defence. I've wang on about Dyer O'Shea at right back a lot, but the whole defence for me is a concern, and it kind of feels like they've spent all this money and got all these kind of shiny, new, exciting things further up the pitch. And the defence is still kind of really where they were last time in the Premier League. You've kind of like got a Ferrari. You spent all this money on a Ferrari and then you bought a Fiat engine and just stuck it in there. So it looks great, but it's going to let you down quite a lot. So I'm a bit worried about the defence. I thought it's worth reflecting on it now, because clearly both goals in this game were from defensive errors. Sherpin should have done a lot better with the first goal. And the second goal, he has a bit of a caught in no man's land moment again, similar to the Mbeumo lob at Old Trafford. And, you know, Greaves, I think, also has to be potentially blamed for both goals as well, because he loses Isak for the first one. The second one, he kind of gets turned inside and out by him. So how are you feeling? Is that fair? Because I think, having said that, going into the season, against Sunderland, they scored from a set piece and they didn't really create anything else. And clearly, you'll then go, well, it's Man United and Liverpool. These are top-level teams. But I'm just concerned that, for everything good that Town are hopefully going to do this season with all those exciting attacking players, they might be constantly undermined by the fairly dodgy back line. And there's clearly a conversation around how to shore things up, which we're going to have in a minute. But do you feel that's a fair assessment, defence as a whole being something of a concern?
Yeah, and it's tricky for the exact reason that you mentioned, because they have played Manchester United and Liverpool, and because the Sunderland game defensively, they look so solid. So it is a fair reflection to have, because we can only take the sample size that we've had. At the same time, I'm sure this will be a discussion that we have in a fortnight's time after they played Palace and Everton, and we can maybe have a slightly fairer, I guess, discussion about where they're at, but we can only judge the games that they've had. And of course, they've been punished by high-level opposition. I mean, Gakpo, for both of those goals, was absurd. The pass for the second one was outrageous. But I agree in kind of on both counts there. I think that O'Shea at right-back, to go back to that, he had a tough time against Cody Gakpo, and it kind of felt like he stood off him a little bit. It's a Diop I didn't really think was that involved in that side. Jacob Greaves gets pulled to one side, pulled that position for the first one, but obviously keeper should do better. The second one, again, not sure what's going on with Sherpin, and separate discussions we had about that, but Greaves has offered him the best deal protection, kind of ends up with his little rabbit in the headlights situation as Isak's doing step over, sending him one way and the other. And that is a little bit of a concern in terms of the makeup of it and also just the way that the players are performing. And I rate Jacob Greaves in a lot of ways, and I'm sure he has a part to play. And if he's going to be starting games in the Premier League, then I feel okay with that at the moment. But my concern at the moment is, as good as he can do kind of your bread and butter, head it, kick it, when he's then coming up against really technical attacking players like Isak, like Cody Gakpo, like Munoz, like that is then the side that I start to worry about a little bit more. And there's maybe an argument that Diop, I think, is up a level, but maybe is he still not quite at that stage? O'Shea is someone I think could do better with that kind of those kind of tests, but then the fact that you're putting him out to right back means that he's in a totally different situation there. So all three of those, I have a few kind of at least question marks, if not concerns. On the flip side, I'm going to give some credit to Leif Davis as well, though, because as questionable as the defence has been in the last two Premier League games, the performances that Leif Davis has put in, obviously going forward, but defensively as well, have been a considerable marked improvement on what he was putting in last time in the Premier League. So, it is a concern for me for sure. And it's kind of everything that we looked at when the transfer window shut, wasn't it? They didn't get in the extra body that we felt they needed. And then on top of that, it just all still feels a little bit wonky with O'Shea out of position there.
Is it too simplistic to just say, right, well, let's move O'Shea back inside. He's the captain. He should be playing where he wants to play. Let's play him alongside, I would argue, Diop, although Diop hasn't exactly looked massively solid. Then you're going to have people saying, well, you haven't got a left footer there. But for me, O'Shea, Diop, you know, solid, proven Premier League players. Centre-back, you've got Leif Davis at the left. And I would love to see Ouattara given a chance at right-back. Again, I'm basing that entirely on what the limited bits we've seen of him so far. The fact he's clearly athletic, physical, fast, and I think he's probably more of a Premier League player than say someone like Darnell Furlong at right back. Is that how would you, if I said that's what they should do, what would you say to that?
I think it's a fair consideration, and if I was taking training and I was Gary O'Neill, it's something I would be looking at for sure, just as well to make things feel more natural. I don't think, and I'll admit, in pre-season I saw O'Shea playing at right back and I thought, oh, actually, you know what, everyone's saying that they're not having it in the Prem, and I quite like a bit of this, it's looking quite good, and he scored that goal at Union Berlin and things like that, and hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I probably wasn't right with that. And you can't go into the Premier League, I think, with square pegs and round holes is the main takeaway. So then do you shift things over? I'm not as concerned about the kind of the centre-back pairing of putting Diop on the left and not having that left footer. But it then kind of just feels like a lack of planning. Like, how have you then got to that position where you've gone and you signed Diop and you've got O'Shea, but then you haven't gone and got that left-footed centre-back? That feels like they're lacking something there. And Ouattara is an interesting one because we still don't know necessarily what the role is. We've heard Gary O'Neill say, there is a position I've got in mind. Now, the majority of his minutes have come in midfield. But he started, his one start was in the cup, and he played at left back in that one. So we're talking about him playing a position he's not even played a single second in for Ipswich, and him trying to nail down that position. And he's done it before. He's played that spot for Strasbourg. But Ligue 1 is not the Premier League, and it is very different to playing the left wingers of, I don't know, Bordeaux don't exist anymore, but I don't know, an Auxerre or even a Marseille or someone like that, compared to coming up against Liverpool, City, Chelsea, Arsenal, even teams like Villa, the options that they have on that side, and his lack of experience as well. He's not got bags of it, and coming up against these kind of players, he's got a lot of the attributes that I think could work, but it is also a risk. So, it's something that Ipswich, I think, need to find solutions to. I wouldn't then suddenly swing massively and say they need to tear everything up and start again. But I think there's maybe a debate to be had around the balance of it. I mean, I'm still a big advocate of a back five, and I'm not saying that as kind of a set, let's go into a back five every game, be a bunch of hard bastards, sorry for kind of swearing, every single time, and sit back and try and strike on the counter. But Gary O'Neill says he's flexible going into games. We've seen Ipswich take quite similar approaches in the last two games, and I would like to see a little bit more variation and just a little bit more balance and structure, especially in the back line going forward.
I was going to ask you about that specifically, purely because O'Neill did say there was going to be, you know, flexibility and switching of tactics depending on the opponent. But are you surprised that we've not really seen much of that thus far? It's essentially been the same approach, yeah, hasn't it, against everyone?
Yeah, and the thing that threw me off the most is, I assume you saw this, but I spoke to Leif Davis at Old Trafford after the game, and he mentioned, oh, we went to a back five in game. We've not practiced a back five in training, which really surprised me, given that all the talk of kind of tactical flexibility and the fact that O'Neill got so much success out of a back five at Wolves. I thought that they would have kind of trained and practiced with that a little bit more. But they seem quite stuck to the 4-2-3-1 approach at the moment. We'll see how long that lasts. And I do think that going forward, you know, with they've kind of got this break, don't they, at the moment from your top six, your big six teams. They don't have to. The next one they've got in the league is City next month. And they've now got a run of games, especially the next three, which feel very significant against teams that you would expect will be in and around where Ipswich are going to be. And those are the ones where I guess is going to be the test of, do they have the, is this system strong enough to be able to compete in the Premier League, strong middle and back, or do you then need to look at changes? So I still think that when they go to the Etihad, as something that O'Neill's directly referenced, and when they've got to go to Anfield and they've got to play Arsenal home and away, Chelsea home and away, I still would like to see that five. I think that's where I feel a little bit more comfortable with someone like Ouattara playing more as a right wing back. He's then got the cover from O'Shea behind him. You've then still got Diop Greaves and Davis there as well. And there are games, and I it kind of brings me back to this game against Liverpool, where I just want them to be a bit nastier and a bit harder to watch almost. I sometimes still feel that they're trying to be too good on the eye and they're trying to play these teams at their own game. Ipswich will not beat Liverpool or Manchester United by playing them at their own game. You've got to be closer to what Hull have been so far this season, which has been pretty ugly and pretty tough to watch, but they've not conceded a goal so far this season. Having played United and Villa, and I'm not saying that it needs to be like that. I'm not saying it needs to be as intense and strong as that, but it probably needs to be a bit more of a balance, especially in those games where they're playing the best teams in the world.
Yeah, and I thought they'd learned that. I thought we'd learned that last time out, you know, trying to play against the best sides. You can't. You have to find different ways of beating them, and you have to make yourself hard to beat.
Yeah, but it's a hard balance to find as well, because then I'm saying to you, okay, we're going to go to back five. What's the attacker you're taking out? Who are you taking out of the team?
Well, I suppose Fatu, I guess.
So you're taking out the player that probably had the most X factor at Old Trafford in terms of what he was able
I'm not saying
you would want to, but yeah, that's then the debate that you've got to have. Who do you take out? I would agree, by the way. I would take out Fatu if it was going to be me, just because not only do I question some of his off-the-ball stuff a little bit, I was frustrated by him over the weekend, I think he'd be a really good impact sub to bring on in the second half of kind of games where you might be trying to take it 0-0 to 60, 70 minutes. And then you bring on that kind of player against a tired Man City backline, for example. That's still the debate you've got to have, though. Do you take Nciso out? No, you're not insane. Do you take Maida out, but then you lose his off-ball work? How do you balance it? So it is tricky, and it's made trickier by the fact that you're trying to add another body into the back line when you're still not feeling too good about the defensive options that Ipswich have in general, and you feel really good about the attacking options that they have, but that's where you're then taking the player out of the team. So it does leave Gary O'Neill with a bit of a headache, I think.
Right, Kel Sherpin then. Talk to me about Kel Sherpin, because clearly there are criticisms out there about him. He's going to kind of suffer by comparison to Aaron Murich, who, you know, also didn't have the best start to his Ipswich Town career. You'd say that he's been at fault for three of the goals they've conceded so far. And I do wonder if he's kind of struggling with the pace of the Premier League. given he, you know, a couple of those goals, he's found himself in no man's land. Maybe doesn't quite used to the speed of these players in the Premier League and how quickly they cover the ground. It's that old objects in the rearview mirror. In this case, objects in front of you are approaching faster than you think. And clearly there are people already saying, well, you know, let's get Walton in. You got any thoughts on that? Because for me, you can't drop Sherpin this early in his Town career. We've got to try and get behind him, I think, and hopefully he'll develop quickly. He's got size and that kind of physical presence. And we've seen him make some good saves as well. It's just unfortunate when you're a keeper, you make a mistake, it tends to lead to a goal. And especially if you're a new keeper, you know, that's immediately then there's fingers pointed at you and you've got someone behind you who played all of last season. And inevitably the clamour is, well, get him in then. What do you make of the Sherpin debate?
This is my hot take. This is exactly what I said would happen. This is really, it really annoys me that this is what I said would happen. I would rather it didn't happen, unfortunately. But I want to pivot away from that and look at kind of the good stuff to come from Kel Sherpin, because you mentioned there have been good saves, there has been good work with the ball at his feet. I think he is a big asset, pardon the pun, to have from set pieces. And as well, I kind of almost bring you up on that a little bit. You say at fault for the goals, and that's maybe where I still question things a little bit. It's still a collective improvement that I think Ipswich need to make, and he has a part within that. And that's saying that take the goal at Old Trafford, the one where he got lobbed. Yes, he comes off his line. He needs to have much better spatial awareness. How have United had 1-2 passes and they're in down the right? How is that able to happen? Then I put the criticism onto probably Davis, I thought was caught out on that side, and Greaves a little bit. Then we look at the goals against Liverpool. And yes, he should do much better for that Isak shot. It is hit with venom, it should be said, but he'll be really disappointed with that. But then how is Gakpo allowed to kind of take the ball into space, get past Palacios so easily? I don't want to kind of throw him under the bus. It's kind of full debut, but he was beaten probably a little bit too easily there for me. And then that one pass to take Greaves out, that's again is a collective thing. He shouldn't be able to get into that shooting position. And then the second goal that Liverpool score, again, how is that one pass able to take out Liverpool's entire back line? Greaves is not really offering the right level of protection down that side. Having O'Shea on that side means that there's not really that right kind of 1v1 battle against Gakpo. So yes, there are definitely things I want Sherpin to do better with, but it is also still a collective improvement that Ipswich need to make. My concern is that, and I think we saw this with Arrow, one mistake can see your confidence crash totally. So I hope that Kel Sherpin has got that kind of mentality. I hope he's not on social media, because you see a lot of nonsense that comes up on there. But I hope that he has that kind of strong mentality where he can make a mistake or two mistakes or three, but he still backs himself to be the number one at this level and to say, I am good enough to stop these shots, to make these saves, to do all of this. That's maybe where my concern comes, because there were a couple of occasions where two errors could have been three or four. He had one for the penalty that was given away that was then overturned by VAR, where I think it was Szoboszlai goes kind of through on goal and Davis gets two, three grabs of the shirt and ends up bringing him down. It's given as a penalty. Sherpin's halfway off his box, out of his box by that point as well. There's a couple of other occasions. So I can take the good from it. I can definitely take it as a areas to improve, and I take it as a collective area to improve. He, in my mind, comes with the back line as almost like a package. But you can't be saying this. We can't have a Muric situation where Ipswich play him over and over again and it's mistake after mistake after mistake, and all of a sudden he's cost you X amount of points by October, November. So I'm fully backing him, 100%, as you are. But certainly there does need to be an improvement in that aspect, or then when we get to, let's say, the international break or into October, you'd have to have a conversation about making a change.
Yeah, okay. There's some concerns then. Should we talk about some positives? Because I think there were positives from the game, certainly not as many as the previous games, but I guess number one on that list would be the full debut of Ezequiel Palacios, who I thought
you love
was,
it. I love saying it.
I've now added the Quiel into it as well. Ezequiel. I'm going to say it like that. I don't care if that's how you say it. How it's spelled. Ezequiel. I thought he was really good in obviously a difficult game, given the game was over after 10 minutes, but he showed some real class, AJ, I thought, in there. lots to be excited about, particularly when, you know, it's not Liverpool or Man United every week. What did you make of him in terms of the full debut?
It was fascinating watching him almost kind of develop on the pitch. I thought he found, and it was a collective thing, I thought he found the first 10 minutes really hard. I thought that you could see that the pace of the game was tricky for him. And it kind of felt like a bit of a baptism of fire, the way that Liverpool, I mean, they ping it around. It's just bam, bam, bam. Mm. They can do 2-3 passes and they've cut you open. They play with such pace and intensity, but also this kind of effortlessness. And I think that that first kind of 10 minutes passed him by a little bit. And it wasn't just him. It should be said it was a collective thing, the whole team. And then he grew into the game as it kind of, I suppose, it eased a little bit and there was more space for him to do stuff. But what really impressed me with Palacios was how calm he was under pressure when he had the ball. And there were a couple of occasions where he dropped a little bit deeper. I want to still see him in more advanced areas. That will come with easier games, you would hope. Mm. But he dropped into deep areas. He'd get given the ball. Everyone knows it's kind of, if you give him the ball, he can make stuff happen because his passing range, and he showed that in this game, was really good. And at times he had no help at all. Like, he had nothing around him. He would, apart from just being swarmed by red shirts, but he still was able to kind of turn and turn and turn and work his way out of pressure and then release that by making the right pass and stretching play, doing stuff like that. Just knitted things together quite nicely. Lukic, another one who found periods of this game hard. I just think it'll be a nice partnership there. I think that's something that will work. I like lots of it. I think he won the ball. It might have been like the most of anyone on the pitch. Like, the way he regained possession was really, really good. So, yeah, if this is a sign of things to come, that's really promising. And I would also like to see it happen against midfielders that aren't among the best in world football. Yeah.
And that's what we're going to get to see, isn't it? Over the next three games, certainly. How about the other debut maker? And I hesitate to ask you about this because obviously you're massively biased.
10 out of 10.
Yeah. Perfect 10. Remarkable. We're going to talk about his press conference actually later on, because obviously it was the first meeting of you two football friends since Millwall. But, clearly, you know, Emerson started. I thought it was the right thing to do to start Emerson. Fleming comes on in a difficult situation where they're chasing the game. Emerson hadn't really had a lot to work with. What did you make of Zian, though, in this game? Could you kind of form any opinions of him? I guess you kind of saw what you expected from him, did you?
A little bit. I mean, again, he still feels like he's turned into more of a target man. The season I covered him at Millwall, he was a 10. So this is the first time I've watched him playing as like an out-and-out number 9 up front. And he's much more kind of industrious and physical. He really got himself about. And the one thing that impressed me, and you maybe don't get this as much from Emerson, where Emerson is like, you know, you're going to get the height and the build-up play and the movement, stuff like that. Fleming presses. He will run and he will run. And if the centre-back's on the ball, he will barge them over. And if he fouls the man, then so be it. And if he doesn't, then great. And that's what I liked about him. He has that physical edge and he likes to showcase it and he likes to get himself about. It was a very difficult game for him to come on in. Had one shot that I think he curled into Alisson's gloves. Again, when he has more kind of space and time to operate with, or kind of on the ball, I think he'll get better. But early doors, I think he definitely feels like he's the right physical profile and he kind of complements Emerson quite well, and that they're very different, I think, in terms of their physicality. One who's got that height, who can move very nimbly, but is also good with the ball at his feet. And one of them who just feels like a bit of a bruiser as well.
Yeah.
I mean, O'Neill mentioned him as a target man, but I like that he's got that aspect to him. As well, there's almost a bit of Delap in him. I don't think he's got kind of like the recklessness that Delap had, but I think that he's kind of got some of those physical traits in the ways. But he's not that massive, is he? He's not like that tall. No. But he's kind of got this kind of muscly low centre of gravity, which I think works quite well. And we saw some of that in this game, yeah.
You have to mention his muscles, don't you, every time.
But he is. You've seen him. He's built. He's a bit of a unit, isn't he?
Yeah, yeah. The lad was a bit like a bull in a china shop, wasn't it? A runaway train.
Yeah,
interesting. Okay, I want to talk to you next. The next talking point is what I'm calling the Jack Clark conundrum, because it's pleasing alliteration. What do you make of this Jack Clark situation? We've talked a lot about Jack Clark over the summer. And, you know, my concerns about him being a player that can succeed in the Premier League. Now we sit three games in. He scored the winner against Sunderland. I think he's looked dangerous every time he's come on. I saw a stat that said within the first 5 minutes of coming on against Liverpool, he'd already touched the ball more than Dyson Maeda had. And yet I can't ever see him really starting because he doesn't bring what Maeda does, which is the incredible non-stop pressing. I'd say he's faster than Jack Clarke. He's not skillful. He's not as good an attacking player as Jack Clarke. But in the Premier League, obviously that pressing, that constant motion is really important, isn't it? And Jack Clarke isn't going to give you that, I don't think. So
no,
where are we with the Jack Clarke thing? Because you've also got toss in, of course, Jaden Finnegan, who's going to come back into the mix. And where does he fit? Does he start? You know, that kind of stuff. Because again, I don't think he will do the sort of work that Maeda will do. So where are we with this left wing problem, headache?
I don't think any of us expected Ipswich to have these three players on the books going into the season.
Yeah.
I think we all expected kind of midway, latter stages of the summer that Jaden Philogene would be moving on. But it looks like we'll have all three fit and firing and available. And again, another real headache for Gary O'Neill to try and piece this puzzle together. I think I agree in terms of Jack Clarke not being the man who's going to be starting at least week in, week out. I think if you're going to have him, as a starter, it needs to be a game that you feel confident that Ipswich will have either the majority of the ball or just kind of be the more dominant side, because obviously his off the ball qualities aren't as strong as Dyson Maeda in terms of, as you mentioned, the pressing, but also the defensive work, aspects of things like that. And that's why I think Maeda will be the man to play, especially the kind of the top tier games like City, games like Liverpool, United scene. And it's tricky because I've kind of come away from these games. I can't really remember. He had a shot against United, but I can't remember what else he did, to be honest, in any of them. And part of that is because they're not kind of utilising him as someone. It is literally just run and tire out your fullback, and then when that fullback's tired, we'll bring on Jack Clarke, who can then run at a tired Premier League fullback, and then we'll create those chances. I think that is actually quite a nice balance to have with Jack Clarke, have him come on against tired legs. Maybe that will work with Jaden Philogene as well. It doesn't feel to me like Ipswich are still playing to Maeda's strengths. It doesn't feel that they're using that space and opportunities that he has to go down that left side on the counter. It feels like every time they're playing on the counter, it's all going down Fatu's side. It's all down there. And I just want them to be able to use that other flank a little bit more, because that's what he's got. He's going to be one of the fastest players in the league. He's going to be so suited to this counter-attacking play. But I just feel that Ipswich are struggling to get him into these games at the moment. And that is a bit of a shame, I suppose. I hope it will come again with time. But I still think the best structure to have is with him starting games, with him running at defenders, hopefully getting more opportunities, hopefully with Ipswich working to get him into games more. And then you can bring on a Jack Clarke who can dribble and doesn't have to worry about the defensive side as much down that side towards maybe the latter stages of the game if Ipswich are chasing an equaliser or a winner. And then Jaden Philogene, where does he fit in? That's another headache to have entirely when you've got all of these players, and you're now also having the debate as well. When these guys come back, how do you fit them all onto a bench? Because I don't know where Azor Matasiba is going to go at the moment. I don't know where Jaden Philogene is going to go. Who are you taking out? Do you take Casey McAteer out? But then he's your only other right sider. Poor Sindre Valarighelli didn't even make the squad against Liverpool, the team that he supports. What happens with Nunez? What happens with the defenders? Yeah, it's a real tricky balance to find. But the left wing solution, I think, will be Maeda starting and Clarke and Philogene in more of a supporting role. But who knows? This is really my view. Yeah.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because Philogene, clearly last season, was one of Town's stars. He had that, goal of the season competition with himself. And you say that he can be a difference maker in the Premier League, but probably not in the way that Maeda is.
Are they physical enough? Do you think they're physical enough in terms of that? As starting players?
I don't think Clarke is. I've said that before. I think Jaden's probably a little bit more, because he's faster, isn't he? Probably has a bit more to add to that side of things. But still, I think you're right in that if you're going to start them, it needs to be games where you're confident that Town are going to have more of the ball.
Yeah, I just feel that in some moment you can see that Maida's a little bit stronger. He's stronger.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely stronger, yeah.
He, again, sorry for going back to it, he's well built. He's got muscles. Yeah,
got big legs. Got that,
yeah, big legs. He's a powerful runner. And when you're coming up against Premier League right backs, the majority of them are very athletic players.
Hmm.
Now, it's a very different situation then when you are coming up against them from the start of a game compared to the end of the game. Because obviously, towards the end, you're more tired. You're unlikely to change a right back, I would say. Over the course of a 90 minutes, they're likely to play the entire match. And then you've got a situation where you can then bring Jack Clark on to have more of that kind of run against a top-end right-back who just might not be quite as sharp and on it. And that's where, for example, you saw Jack Clark against Meunier. I think he was still on the pitch at that point, and he was looking a little bit tired towards the latter stages of that game and on the opening day. And then he comes inside, beats one, beats two, tired defenders, opens the space, takes the shot and scores. But I don't think that's going to happen. Like, if you put Clark on that left wing spot up against Araujo on Friday night against Liverpool, I don't think he would have had any more of a sniff than Dyson Maida did.
Yeah. I just wonder how, because you want players on the bench, don't you, to come on, that can come on and change the game. And Clark and Philogene both fit that. But the problem is they both play the same position. They both can't come on the left wing. So
had this debate last year when we were talking about starting one and benching one. Now you're talking about starting one and benching two at this point. That's the balance that you've got to find. And I mean, here as well, take it back to the back five debate, right? If you're taking one of those players out, one of the attacking players, to fit in another defender, that means you're going to have another attacking player on the bench. You can't just have a bench full of attackers. Someone's going to have someone has to come out of the squad. Yeah. And then you look at the attacking options, and I mean, sorry to say, but we'd probably both look at Casey McAteer as the one that would stand out. And then you're saying, but then if you take him out, who's your natural right sider? Jaden Philogene's not the same on the right, nor is Jack Clark. So the squad gives me a headache still.
Yeah.
That is the best way I can put it. So I don't know how Gary O'Neill feels just trying to balance all of these things together and deal with prioritising playtime. He's probably, sounds bad to say, he's probably quite happy that Jaden Philogene's just out of the picture a little bit. Oh, he's got a knock. I don't have to worry about how I'm going to balance all these left wingers together. I don't know. And it's going to be fascinating to see how the minutes are spread out and how places on the bench even are spread out over the course of the next 3, 4, 5 games.
Going to be managing egos as well, isn't it? Because, you know, Jaden Philogene thinks he should be starting. I imagine Jack Clark thinks he should be starting. A lot of these players think they should be starting. So, interesting. And that's, of course, why he gets paid the big bucks and we're sitting here talking about it. AJ, I want to have a little period of reflection now. We're 3 games in. The 3 points on the board. There's been plenty to be positive about. Equally, as we say, certainly Friday night, I thought was a little bit of a step backwards. Maybe because expectations were higher than they perhaps should have been. You know, previously when they're last in the Premier League, home game against Liverpool, you'd say, oh, you're probably not going to win that. We'll get anything out of it. This time I felt genuinely like they could get something out of it. So maybe it's that kind of giddiness of expectation. But sitting here now, 3 games down, they've got a win on the board. The next 3, as you say, are huge in terms of the context of the season. How are you feeling about things? How would you kind of sum up your feelings? Are you more optimistic than you thought you'd be at this point? Have you seen more things to like than you thought you would have done? Are there more things that you're worried about that maybe you thought you wouldn't be?
The boring answer is I think it were probably on course at the moment for where I thought they'd be and where I think they should be. To be honest, to play devil's advocate, you're betting in 14 players, 12 of them new signings. That's not easy into a new squad. I appreciate Hull have done more of that and have got good results, but it's not an easy thing to do, especially when you're trying to play a very attacking style of play, not very attacking, but quite an attacking style of play as a newly promoted team. That's not an easy thing to do because it is very much a case that by the looks of it, Ipswich aren't looking to go up and sit deep and strike on the counter and win games 1-0. They want to play football and entertain and get bums off seats and stuff like that. So overall, I think that they're in a pretty good spot because, as I said in pre-season, they need to win one of those opening 5 was what I said. They did that on opening day. They've won the game against Sunderland, and they've lost the following two, which is probably what a lot of us felt would be the case when we looked at the fixtures in pre-season. That felt like a good return, and we can kind of have the points in the bank and then have your baptism of fire, I suppose, against the other two. So I think it's all quite positive. Things are gelling nicely. Individuals are doing well. We've been impressed by Nciso and Fatuu and Emerson and Palacios. They're not all going to have great performances all the time, but I think we all feel quite buoyed by what we've seen so far. This is now the test. This is the big point now, is how they're going to go about these next few games. I think that lessons have to be learnt from the last two, because if they're going to get points against top teams, they have to realise, Ipswich have to realise, they just can't do what they've done in the last two games, which is go toe-to-toe with them, because they will lose. They will lose those games. As good as the squad is that Ipswich have, they cannot go toe-to-toe with Liverpool and win that game in where they are as a newly promoted team. And it's the same with United, and it'll be the same with Chelsea and Arsenal. I just need them to be more sturdy and resilient and a bunch of hard bastards, basically, in those games. And now is going to be a test of how they can stand toe-to-toe, because I'm sure they will, against Palace and against Everton and against Fulham. And these next three feel very, very significant in terms of dictating what this season is going to look like, especially in my mind, the Palace game and the Fulham game.
Yeah,
because they look a little bit chaotic, I think is the best way to say. Fulham have lost all three of their opening games. At least they've got points on the board, and at least we don't have to have this debate of, God, when's that first win going to come? And it comes in November away at Spurs, and then the next one after that was Chelsea, wasn't it? Like, we've avoided that. They've got the points on the board. They've got the monkey off the back. Yeah, it's now about managing that narrative as well, because a lot of it coming off the back of these last two games against Man United and against Liverpool has been, you know, you tune into the match of the day. I watched it with the audio off on Saturday night. And I'd imagine that a lot of it was going to be, well, you know, too naive from a newly promoted team, clearly going back down, no lessons learned from last time, spent all this money, but definitely getting relegated. That needs to be blocked out. And Ipswich needs to very much control their own narrative and storyline when it comes to this. But if they're going to do that, they're going to need to be very competitive and pick up some good points from the next three.
Yeah, I do feel like they can. And I think, as you say, getting that win on the board, I think, is already a massive kind of thing to have, a mental tick, if you like. Because even though they've lost these last two games, they look at the table and they're still, you know, 3 points on the board, and they're above all a bunch of other teams. What were you made about the rest of the league? Because we're always, who can they finish above? Now, Coventry have lost all three. You say Fulham have lost all three, so they're struggling. Are there sides you think it's going to be? Last time it was kind of like they got cut adrift, didn't they? Do you think it's going to be a lot closer this time around in terms of the teams that are going to be dragged into it? We've already talked about Palace and Fulham.
I think so, but we thought that in the early stages. I remember going into that Palace game in December 2024, and I remember saying this is a big opportunity against a team that they realistically can catch and drag down there. And Palace won that horrible game. I think it was 1-0.
I spoke about how Mateta, wasn't it, when you got that?
Yeah, one. Mateta. Yeah. Was it 1-0? 2-0?
I think it was 1-0. Yeah.
1-0. And I remember saying on the pod, the biggest thing that stood out to me is that they had a load of beefy centre backs that were all about 6'4", and they just swatted Ipswich attackers away with ease. And Palace went on to finish comfortably in mid table in that season. So it's very easy to say yes at the moment when you're looking at Fulham and Coventry and teams like that. I think Coventry are about where I expected them to be. I always really expected that they were going to struggle, and they feel very Ipswich of 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And I think they're going to try and play a little bit too much, as much as they did actually do very well at Man City over the weekend. But I just think this is too big a step up with the squad they've got. The interesting thing is we've spent the whole summer saying they're going to finish above Coventry and Hull, and then they just have to find one other. Yet Hull are currently third.
Yeah, I know.
With 7 points from three games. Their next game, they've got Sunderland, then they've got Chelsea, Newcastle, Everton, Fulham. So, again, we'll reassess in a few weeks' time. But at the moment, they're really impressed. They've yet to concede a goal, as I said. Fair play to them. And then they've now got all these snazzy new signings. They signed like 7 on deadline day or something ridiculous. So fascinated to see them. And then it's a case of, now if you're saying Coventry are probably likely to go back down, who do you find at the moment? Tottenham are 18th. Is it going to be another case of trying to track down Tottenham? Fulham, as I mentioned in pre-season, are the ones I thought would really struggle and it's looking that way, having sold off a lot of their experience and gone with young players. And then you're looking at Palace as well as another one. Sunderland, I suppose, but got a really good result over the weekend. It is hard when you're looking and saying what teams can they finish above of? And many of them are looking pretty good at the moment. So, very difficult to assess so early on, but it's just a reminder of what this league is like, isn't it? Jeez.
Yeah, we're going to have a much better idea, aren't we, after the next three as to where they're kind of sitting and what they can actually achieve, I think.
The timings are really interesting as well, aren't they? Where we talk about the next three and going into Fulham, but it's two and an international break.
Yeah.
It's not just any international break. It's a three-week-long international break, 3 weeks in between these games. That's a hell of a break to have. And I'd almost like the Fulham game to come before that, so you can have these next three, and then you get to the international break and you say, right, do we need to panic? Do we need to tear up and start again tactically, or do we need to, can we say this is what we're doing really well, let's now focus on refining what we're doing? But it's difficult to kind of judge it off these next two. I almost just want that extra Fulham game to get a better picture of it. And I suppose the other tricky thing is when you look through the team, about eight of the starters are going to be off on international duty as well, so it's not like Gary O'Neill's going to have any time to work with them. So yeah, let's wait and see, but certainly these next three games feel like teams who could all be in the mix, although Everton seem actually to be quite good despite everything that happened in the transfer market as well.
Is it a 3 week international break? That's not complete nonsense.
So it's two weekends, so it's basically three full weeks without,
get in the bin.
I know, but it football. Means that we only have one. We don't have another one in October. Remember, it used to be September, then October, and then November, whereas now we just have this big one and then another one in November. But yes, I hate it, and I can already see the panic setting in about how we're going to fill all this stuff during the international break without any games. Can't wait.
Exactly. Yeah, we've just had a summer where we had that same problem. Apart from this time, the transfer window open either. I want to talk about, and I've seen today, AJ, that In Between Us 3 is in progress. They're shooting it, which is good. Ooh. Because you have your football friend, Deanne Fleming, who you met at the press conference last week. I think probably the first time since the Millwall days. Lots of people on Twitter and social media wanted to know how that went. Me and I were speculating that we hoped he doesn't just blank you. He does actually remember who you are. So how was it reuniting with your old friend, Deanne, your old Dutch pal, your buddy, your chum? Because he was in good form, wasn't he? I mean, I've already seen...
Yeah.
People picking up the F-bomb and falling in love with him, and he does seem to be quite a compelling character.
Yeah, I'd imagine that him seeing me again, you know that bit from The Office where Ricky Gervais does they're in the pub and turns around and goes, oh,
no.
That one. I assume was a bit like that, probably. He did know I was going to be there, to be fair, so he was well prepared. But it was good to see him again, and it was a traditional Deanne Fleming press conferences. I think I mentioned a couple of times he dropped F-bombs in at least three interviews that I did with him during Millwall days, and also then did one live on Sky where he got chastised live on air at Blackpool by the presenter. He had a real massive go at him. I spoke to him, I gave him a call on the Monday for a chat, and he was like, I don't get it. I don't understand. In Holland, we can just say whatever you want, basically. So, he genuinely has struggled to get to grips with that side of things. But, God, he's confident, isn't he? That's the biggest thing. There were some incredible highlights from this. Graham asked him from BBC Radio Suffolk, who's your biggest inspiration? He just went, myself. And there was the silence for like 3 or 4 seconds as he just looks out. It was great. I thought that was fantastic. There's kind of, I think there's a little naturally a bit Dutch kind of confidence that's kind of a Dutch characteristic, but especially within him. I mean, you spoke about being in the Dutch national team. You know, I said to him, you haven't been called up, is this going to be a name for you? He said, I don't really want to get into it again, I've done another press conference on it, but I was the top goal scorer of any of the Dutch players in the Premier League last year, so I already expected to be in there. Fair enough, strong answer. Just lots of punchy lines from that, which were really good.
I was going to say it gave me Snoop Dogg energy. You know, when Snoop Dogg introduced into, I think it was the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or something, and he said, I'd like to thank me for basically doing all the work.
But he's not boastful at the same time. It doesn't feel like he's coming along. Like he said, for example, he was talking about his comparison with Bradley Barkala. And, you know, say, oh, you're both making your debuts this weekend. And he said, well, yeah, apart from the fact he's a million times better than I am. Like, he knows where he is, but he's also kind of realistic about his aspirations. He spoke to me, I asked, was it always going to be the Premier League? And he said, well, one of my dreams is to go play in the Champions League. I still think I can do that. He's 28 years old, and he's playing for a newly promoted Premier League team. But he still has an aspiration of, he said, playing for one of the top teams in Europe. Like, he's constantly kind of, he mentioned... in this, he likes feeling like he's at the bottom of a mountain looking up, which I think was like quite a nice comparison. And of course, the big takeaway was the question I asked, the last question I asked, is he going to bring traitors to the dressing room? He did it at Millwall, he did it at Burnley, played this to try and get like build some unity in the dressing room and get the new players to bed in. And everything I've heard, like from all the players who've mentioned about it, and there've been some YouTube clips and stuff like that, fantastic. So I'm really, really hoping that they'll get everyone on board and they'll play that, especially with Celebrity Traitors coming later this month. Town TV, get recording. I want to see this.
Who would be Claudia, though?
He is Claudia.
He's Claudia, is he? Okay.
He is Claudia. He does this role. He is so kind of meticulous in it. I've heard all of these stories. You can see him like going around and reading, like picking the traitors, and he'll be the one who comes into breakfast and he'll like read out the announcements and who's been killed. There's a WhatsApp group. It sounds great. And he takes it so seriously. And I love it. It's great.
Yeah. Celebrity Traitors is coming back, mate. End of the month. Going to be great. Got some serious big hitters in there again.
Harry Hill, isn't it? I think he's in there.
I think Harry Hill's in
there. No, is he in the other one? Is he in that one? I can't remember. Yeah, either way. He's also doing Last One Laughing. I don't know if you've ever watched that.
I have. I do quite enjoy that.
Yeah, he's in that as well, I think. But
I don't know if he's in the Traitors. I know Traitors.
No, he might be in the other one.
It's Richard E. Grant and Michael Sheen and all those kind of proper big names. Bella Ramsey's in it.
Bella Ramsey, that was who I was thinking of. Yeah. So they're hitting some real A-listers in there as well.
They've got some money, haven't they? Clearly.
Yeah, I know.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it. Anyway, anything else to mention? AJ, in terms of kind of general thoughts, feelings and reflections about anything before I do the sponsor push? We've got a shout out we have to give because Ross has WhatsApped us instructions, which I'll do if you haven't got anything else to discuss.
In terms of the football stuff, not massively. I think we've done a nice little breakdown of everything and a look ahead to what's to come. I'm sure we'll do some more later in the week building up to the very important games. And I keep forgetting there's Arsenal like a week says, just the Premier League champions coming to town. Just have that in the back of your mind somewhere. I feel like we should do our own traitors podcast. It would be great. It's like assessing it after. We shouldn't, but I would also enjoy it.
That's definitely going to get brought up at some point when that starts rolling again. Traitors is one of the most fun formats as well. Mm. Right then.
Nope, all good.
I thought you were going to jump in.
Crack on.
Well, we had a little message. Ross is off today, and he sent us a message into the group chat saying, give Richard the Postie a shout-out on the pod today. He's a big listener and KOA subscriber, one of the £29 a year subscribers as well, which we very much enjoy, annual subscribers. He says he's just bumped into him in town. He says, thanks to us all for the content. And he's taken a selfie with Ross, which Ross, I'm sure, would have enjoyed, to show his wife. who always says you're watching the guys again. So Richard the Postie, much appreciated. Thanks for your support of KOA.
Thank you, Richard.
I hope you've enjoyed getting a selfie with Rossie and your wife is suitably impressed. Friends, just a reminder then, just support our sponsor, use code KOA10 at molecular-uk.com for 10% off all their excellent car cleaning products. And also, if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, just helps lift us visibility-wise in the charts and helps more people find us. And also follow us across all social medias, Kings of Anglia on YouTube, Instagram, Twitter /X, Facebook, TikTok. I think that's all of them, isn't it? And me, AJ and Ross are all on Blue Sky as well. If you're on there, come and join us. And I am going to be taking a little leave, friends. I am on holiday, not from now, but for the next week or so, I'll be in Italy. What's that I hear people saying? Not another holiday. Yes, another holiday. I deserve it. I work bloody hard. So I'll be going off to Italy. I'll leave you in the capable hands of the boys, who are obviously going to be back later on this week to build up to the big game, a big game at Crystal Palace, and then several big games coming up over the next few weeks. So hopefully when I return from Italy, We're talking about big wins, big results for Ipswich Town. Until then, friends, have a great start to your week, a great weekend, and I'll see you soon. Ciao. Arrivederci.
Here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Andy and Anna here from your new favourite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.